Hey there, and welcome to the latest episode of Mobile Wallet Marketing Made Easy, the podcast that helps you navigate the ever-changing landscape of mobile marketing.
Hey there, and welcome to a new episode of Mobile Wallet Marketing Made Easy. We'd like to welcome you to the latest episode. I'm Kim Stewart.
And I'm Hazel Fruitman.
And this time we're talking about cannabis banking and what the options might be. It's a common misconception among nearly everyone that banks cannot open accounts for cannabis and marijuana companies. We see this repeated all over the place, all over the media, all over message boards. But the bottom line is, this is not really true. And we're going to prove to you that it's not really true in a two-part podcast that's going to discuss the Cole Memo and FinCEN reporting. This is part one. We're going to walk through the Cole Memo, discuss the history of how we got to where we are now with it. And then in the next episode, we're going to talk directly about the FinCEN reporting guidelines and what we think they mean for this industry. This is an ongoing topic, and as I said, we're not going to cover everything in this episode. We're going to talk about Cole, the basic history, and get going that way. So, we're really glad you're joining us today. We've got a full show. We're going to break down the language in a number of official government documents and talk about what the actual meaning likely is versus the generally construed and possibly misconstrued idea that people have about banking in the cannabis business.
But first thing, a little bit about us. I'm Hazel, that was Kim, and we're from mobilewalletmarketer.com. And we have a SaaS platform that enables small business owners to use the power of mobile to reach out and engage prospects and customers with timely offers that generate more leads, more sales, and more referrals. We normally do a two-minute explainer that details how our platform works, but we're going to skip that today and dive right into the topic at hand. If you're not into the topic, and we're sure that some of you are not, please check out the library at dominoresearch.com/podcast. There are tons of episodes about mobile marketing broken down by industry, and plenty of case studies and more to keep you busy.
Exactly. So let's just jump in here. There is a huge misconception in the United States about what is allowed and what is not allowed with banking the marijuana industry. This applies to both deposit and transaction processing. It can apply to loans as well as any other transactions that involve financial institutions. And the real misconception here, it repeats itself day after day in articles, in the news. It's super frustrating if you ask me. Now, I'm not saying that there is a law or an actual exemption to a law that tells bankers they should be running to sign up dope shops and give them banking and card processing, because that's not it at all, and I don't want to imply that. What I am saying is that there are plenty of banks who are openly dealing with cannabis and marijuana companies, and these banks and financial institutions, credit unions, they're filing the correct reports with the Financial Crimes Enforcement Division of the Treasury Department, which is what we refer to as FinCEN, and these guys have been doing this openly and not in hiding for multiple years now.
But Kim, what about all those U.S. banks that sent letters to Uruguay telling them to stop selling adult use recreational cannabis, which is legal across their entire country?
Well, yeah, that's super crazy too. And I think they should stop picking on poor Uruguay. I mean, the U.S. banks aren't telling the Dutch banks that they can't process or bank for the cannabis cafes in Amsterdam. And nobody's telling Germany that if the state insurance is going to pay for medical cannabis, that we're no longer going to do any business with Germany as a country because their country is involved in medical cannabis. Same thing with Canada. And I'm not entirely sure why the U.S. banks decided to pick on Uruguay, other than the fact that it's a tiny little country. Yeah. It is in South America. It does happen to be close to some of the known historically drug-running countries like Colombia and places like that, and they don't have a lot of leverage. They don't have the ability to fight back against the U.S. banks, and that's really where the problem lies In my opinion, I try to tell people this all day long, but they continue to make the argument that somehow the FDIC refusal to insure bank accounts that are dealing with cannabis funding is the reason for no banking. Well, you know, this is not correct. It doesn't make any sense. And to me, it's a lot more of a red herring than anything else. If I own a cannabis business and I have $500,000 hidden in holes in the ground or under my mattress or whatever, putting that $500,000 in an uninsured bank account, that's actually better for me than keeping it in cash laying around somewhere. And, you know, the next thing people jump up with is how credit unions don't follow federal laws or credit union funds aren't federally insured. Okay, well, this makes me want to shake my head or maybe just pick the person up and shake them instead. That probably would make me feel better. You know, I had an exchange with somebody in the comments on Leafly the other day, and this guy could not, would not understand for any reason that this wasn't an insurance matter. Like, I pointed out a case that just was in federal court with the Fourth Union Credit Union, or Fourth Corner Credit Union, and we're going to talk about that later, but this involved the Kansas City Fed and their refusal to certify the credit union, even though they had been granted a charter by the state of Colorado. So what that meant was the credit union didn't get routing numbers, didn't get SWIFT codes, and was therefore unable to function as a bank. And the function of a bank is not to be a safe. If you want a safe to put your cash in and just have your cash not disappear, then you need a safe. But if you actually want to be able to write a check to pay your taxes, write a check to pay your employees, get a credit card to be able to order something and have it delivered to your business, these are the things that require you to have a bank. So the insurance is really the least important part of the situation.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see what, or if anything, the U.S. banks do to threaten Canada next year when the rec use implementation goes into effect in June, if it does happen.
Right. I mean, we really should look at doing another show in a month or two about the Canada situation. I think we just had one that ran a few episodes ago that detailed the legislation, the new legislation. I think the date on it was like sometime right the very last week of August, maybe?
I believe it is. I believe it's episode 48. So if you haven't listened to it yet and you're at all interested in cannabis in other countries or want to hear more about the Canadian opportunities, this is a great episode to listen to. So many companies are putting investment capital into Canadian marijuana stocks and businesses. That's crazy. We actually have a wide variety of episodes to deal with, specifically what cannabis-related topics. And of course, we have the rest of the library that touches on mobile marketing and advertising, some interesting case studies with suggestions on how to use mobile to really make an impact on the business's bottom line.
You know, it's really funny when I think about it. We certainly never set out to work with developing cannabis banking options or processing options, and it's taken us a long time to come around to this.
Yeah, in case you're listening and don't know the story, we started with the ad platform and then thought we'd adapt it to cannabis as a standalone product. We knew a lot of people in the business, and with Kim's experience in processing, people were hitting us up to help them find processing initially. And the next thing you know, we figured out that we had the cart before the horse. So many companies are struggling to open and maintain a deposit account, somewhere to park their money legitimately. And if a business owner doesn't have a bank account, we can't help them with transaction processing, since there's nowhere to deposit their funding.
Which leads us to where we are now. We are currently, as a sort of a parallel business to our mobile advertising business, we are helping state-licensed cannabis companies qualify for regular bank accounts, and we are working diligently with a number of partners to try to find ways to keep it from being cost-prohibitive to do this. Now, we ran a series of articles in the CannabisWallet.net blog a few months ago. It was a four-part series about transaction processing in cannabis. I think it goes back to like February.
That's right.
So if you haven't had a chance to read it, I'm going to suggest you go over to the CannabisWallet.net site and have a look at the articles. We compiled a list of items that you would need as a state-licensed cannabis business owner to qualify potentially for a transaction processing account. And realistically, since the due diligence is the same for all financial institutions, those same components are going to be required of you in order to get a regular depository account. And what I mean when I say a regular depository account is that we're talking about a situation where you have a bank who knows that you're a cannabis business and is willing to work with you within reason, provided they can do their due diligence for you as a cannabis business.
So you prep for one, you prep for the other at the same time.
Exactly. Okay, you know what? Let's try to work our way back to the topic for the episode, which is the Cole Memorandum and the impact it has on the cannabis industry.
Right. So first thing to do here is disclaimer the heck out of this entire episode. We're not attorneys. We don't own or work at banks. And any of this information could be out of date entirely by the time you hear this podcast episode. It is totally possible that the U.S. DOJ, the Treasury, DEA, FDA, or other organizations could step in, change the rules, and append the entire system.
Right. So we don't make the laws, and they are subject to change at any time. But right now, let's go back to 2009, and that was when the Ogden Memo came out. Odds are you've never heard of the Ogden Memo. Most people haven't. So you don't know about it or the history of it. Ogden was a precursor to Cole. Ogden was also a U.S. Assistant District Attorney. And in 2009, he released a memo that was aimed at medical marijuana use. One sentence in particular is a really good summation of the spirit of his memo. And it reads this way. For example, prosecution of individuals with cancer or other serious illnesses who use marijuana as part of a recommended treatment regimen consistent with applicable state law, or those caregivers in clear and unambiguous compliance with existing state law who provide such individuals with marijuana, is unlikely to be an efficient use of limited federal resources.
So all the way back to 2009, there was already pushback from parts of the federal government about prosecuting so-called state legal medical providers of marijuana for medical reasons.
Yes, that's exactly right. Ogden went on to say that if someone was illegally distributing marijuana under these state laws, they were open to prosecution at the federal level, which is very much what the Cole memo clarified a few years later. Now, Cole actually published three different memos.
Okay.
The first one was really bad for the industry. In 2011, his first memo came out, and then there was a wave of crackdowns and prosecutions, even for state legal operations. And the low priority status that Ogden had implied in these prosecutions was kind of discarded. So, in 2013, James Cole came back with a second memo, after the state of Washington had legalized recreational adult use for marijuana. This memo discussed the fact that it was a break with the normal federal and state cooperation on issues like drug use and distribution, but it did imply that the feds would be a little less aggressive towards state legal operations, provided they weren't selling to minors, facilitating other illegal activities, or supporting criminal enterprises.
And the 2013 memo was a warning to the states that were legalizing to make sure their ducks were in a row with regulating and policing those regulations.
Exactly. So that was the big problem. All of a sudden you had states openly breaking with the Fed, going beyond medical, more states were bringing in medical, and now you've got a problem between what the states have done and what the federal government has. So in the 2014 memo, Cole was trying to coalesce the framework into something that was more useful as a whole. So I read an interview, the transcript, that he did with MJ Biz magazine. And one of the quotes that really struck me was, the conclusions that we came to were, number one, we cannot preempt the decriminalization because the CSA itself says the federal government is not preempting the field here. The states are free to have their own laws. So the conclusion was that we could not force the states to abandon their legalization. Now, essentially, people are going to smoke marijuana in those states. We also heard in our legal analysis that if you wanted to, you could probably stop the regulatory scheme because it probably could stop conduct that's illegal under federal law. So we said, what's the point of that? because all we're going to do is cut off our nose to spite our face and help the drug cartels make a lot more money. So what this really means is that when Cole and the DOJ looked at where the situation was going, they realized that the train was leaving the station and they didn't have a way to stop it. He was also pretty frustrated with Congress. And that was for refusing to clarify the situation. So in the great way of American politics and the fact that everybody has their own opinion, this is exactly what happened to him. States started making these new laws and congressmen were calling him up all over the map. Some were saying, don't prosecute anyone in these states. Others were saying, you have to put a stop to this right now. But there was no clear directive from the legislature at the federal level about exactly which way to proceed. So the 2014 memo, the one we currently operate under, said that state legal medical should be exempt from federal dollars being spent to prosecute people in the industry who were state compliant, that the money could be spent better targeting the real culprits, those running drugs across state lines, selling drugs to minors, aiding and abetting criminal drug rings and cartels. So it sort of told the banks that they could participate if they wanted to. And if they were working with state legal companies, the chances of being prosecuted federally were slim. Then we've also got the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment that was introduced into Congress back in 2003, even though it didn't pass until 2014. You know that.
Right.
And this amendment said that federal funds couldn't be used to prosecute state legal medical operations. The original amendment was introduced by a guy named Hinchey from New York, and Rohrabacher, along with Farr from California. Hinchey and Farr were Democrats, and Rohrabacher is a Republican, and he's still in office right now, even though he's not running again next year. It took 9 years to get the bill passed, and it's actually part of appropriations and budget. And it's a critical bill to keep the DOJ in check when we have guys like Jeff Sessions in charge. Now, in 2015, the bill was renewed, but not by Rohrabacher, Farr, or Hinchey. Rand Paul and Cory Booker introduced it and got it through. And then in 2017, Earl Blumenauer, who's a Democrat from Oregon, signed on in January as the lead co-sponsor. So it was included again in this summer spending extension. And then Jeff Sessions sent a letter to every member of Congress asking them not to renew it again. But it passed through committee with a voice vote in June of this year. And Patrick Leahy, who's a Democrat from Vermont, is now an additional sponsor, and he successfully led the voting.
Wow. So let's do a quick recap of what we have so far, Kim. And then we can pick up where we leave off in the next episode. So here's the recap. So number one, in 2003 was the first year that Congress looked at the issue with the Heineke-Rohrabacher bill.
Hinchey.
Thank you. It took 9 years to get it voted into law. Number two, the bill has had tripartisan support, although mostly from Democrats and influential Congress members like Rand Paul, who have also been involved in the continued passage of the bill. All right. Number three, the first memo from the DOJ was Ogden in 2009. Number four, okay, Cole actually wrote three memos, and his first one in 2011 was devastating to the industry. So number five, in 2013, he loosened up the enforcement. And in 2014, the next year, he wrote the memo we currently use. Number six, Attorney General Jeff Sessions is dead set against marijuana use of any kind, and he's working diligently to put a stop to it.
Right. So we should maybe mention that Sessions has also indicated that he's going to restart civil asset forfeiture, which was a program that former Attorney General Eric Holder put to bed back in 2015. So you might be wondering, if you're listening, why does this matter? Well, in my opinion, if Sessions can't get permission from Congress to directly attack the industry, he's probably looking for a backdoor process via the use of civil asset forfeiture. So these policies, under the old policies and procedures, were super nasty, and a lot of states moved to prevent them from being used again or to limit their scope if they're used. But the bottom line is you can tie up someone's capital, inventory, and cash flow so that you can successfully put them out of business in very short order. And whatever Sessions may be, he's not stupid. If he was, there are still people in his office that aren't. So, this week, a guy named Ken Calvert, who's a Republican from California, introduced a bill, H.R. 3354, that would defund Sessions' directive to ramp up the use of civil asset forfeiture. So this is kind of like breaking news, and there's no way to tell at the moment how it's going to be handled in Congress. The bill doesn't have any co-sponsors, but other congressional members, including Mike Lee, who is a super conservative Republican from Utah, has openly criticized the Jeff Sessions plan. Okay. So the other thing, I checked out thehill.com, and it tells us that Justin Amash from Michigan, Warren Davidson from Ohio, those two have submitted separate amendments that would prohibit the DOJ from using funds for adoptive seizures. Two other bipartisan amendments, including one that was submitted by Jamie Raskin of Maryland and Jim Sensenbrenner, also address this. So we've got a lot of action going on surrounding asset forfeiture, and it's certainly going to be a component of what the DOJ can and cannot use going forward. And the faster we get this resolved, I think it's going to be a good thing in regards to the state legal cannabis industry.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. Thank you, Kim. We'll see you back here next time, and we'll be talking a lot more about where things stand legally with cannabis banking and how it can be implemented with a minimum of risk. Thanks for tuning in to Mobile Wallet Marketing Made Easy.